Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Sullivan County Government spokesperson Dan Hoost is here, as he is every Friday. He'll talk about the potential shutdown squeeze on SNAP and HEAP benefits for the community, plus the county's new budget proposal and what it means for your taxes. The Overlooks editor joins us live to talk about how local hunger relief is unfolding in Ulster County as federal aid falters. Legendary indie horror filmmaker Larry Fessenden, who finds fear in loneliness, and the mystery man behind that giant pumpkin on Route 212. Plus the latest episode of our theater podcast, Curtain Call with Tom Candela. That's coming up after the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. More than 40 million Americans are about to lose a chunk of money they get every month to buy groceries. Federal funds for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, will dry up tomorrow. It's a month into the government shutdown. NPR's Kristen Wright reports the Trump administration is under pressure to dip into emergency funds to keep food assistance going.
One in eight people in the U.S. get SNAP benefits to put food on the table. Congress set aside nearly $6 billion for the Agriculture Department to keep funding SNAP in emergencies. But the agency says that money can't legally be tapped into right now. The department argues without Congress appropriating funds for the current fiscal year, there are no contingency funds available now. About half of states disagree and are suing the department. The USDA's lapse of funding plan, dated September 30th, said in the event of a shutdown, SNAP's operations should continue, since the program has been provided with multi-year contingency funds. That plan is no longer on the USDA website. Kristen Wright, NPR News, Washington.
President Trump wants the government shutdown to end. He's demanding that Senate Republicans overturn their filibuster rule and pass a spending bill over Democrats' objections. Senate Republicans have opposed overturning the filibuster. Stocks opened higher this morning after strong earnings reports from some giant tech companies. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose about 60 points in early trading.
Both Amazon and Apple reported better-than-expected sales and profits for the most recent quarter. Amazon's results were boosted by the strong performance of its cloud computing service. Apple reported solid demand for its latest iPhone, which went on sale last month. Chipmaker NVIDIA's CEO met today with South Korea's president while visiting that country for the big Asia-Pacific summit. South Korea plans to buy NVIDIA chips as part of its artificial intelligence campaign. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent has put some numbers behind China's pledge to end its boycott of U.S. soybeans. Bessent says China will buy 25 million tons of U.S. beans in each of the next 3 years, similar to what it was doing before the latest trade war. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Britain's King Charles has stripped his younger brother Andrew of his royal titles and is evicting him from his royal residence. There's been a series of revelations about Andrew's friendship with the late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. American Virginia Giuffre had accused Epstein of sexually trafficking her to Andrew. She took her life earlier this year. Her brother, Sky Roberts, says King Charles's decision means Andrew cannot use the title Prince anymore.
He's just Andrew now, which is great. And my sister would be smiling, and she is from the heavens, I guarantee you. But there needs to be the next step. We need to take the next step here, and he needs to be fully investigated and brought to some sort of account.
Andrew has denied knowing Virginia Giuffre. This is NPR. The ACLU of Illinois is suing federal immigration authorities. The organization alleges people are being held in, quote, inhumane conditions in an ICE facility near Chicago. The ACLU claims that the people being detained, mostly Latinos, are also being denied the right to talk to lawyers. This year marks the 75th anniversary of Trick or Treat for UNICEF, the UN Children's Agency. The program involves children who collect money for other needy children abroad. Reporter Ari Daniels says the milestone comes as the U.S. dramatically scales back its foreign aid.
Over the years, the UNICEF initiative has been championed by celebrities. It's raised a total of $200 million, paying for food, vaccines, and school supplies. And it's raised awareness among American children of the needs of kids elsewhere in the world.
This program has been running for 75 years for a reason, right? It's that a lot of Americans really do care, despite what's going on in Washington.
Charles Kenny is with the Center for Global Development think tank. Trick or Treat for UNICEF began a decade before USAID was established. Now it appears to have outlasted the foreign aid agency, which the Trump administration has dismantled. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
The police department in Oakland, California says thieves broke into a museum this month. They took more than 1,000 objects, including jewelry, Native American woven items, laptops, and more. The Oakland Museum of California says it hasn't determined the value of all the stolen objects. Police say no one has been arrested. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Focus Features with Begonia. Two conspiracy-obsessed young men kidnap the CEO of a company, convinced that she is an alien intent on destroying Earth. In theaters everywhere today. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. Well, every Friday we hear from Dan Hoos, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government, with the latest from Monticello. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
I want to talk about what's going on with SNAP. A federal judge is weighing in on SNAP benefits, likely this afternoon. It seems as if this judge might order the Trump administration to send some emergency SNAP funding to states. The deadline for that is, of course, tomorrow for the November benefits. But folks in the area, in the county, are already preparing for the potential cutoff of those funds. Can you give us an update on what's going on there? And what, even if these additional funds go through, would do? They're just partial emergency funds.
Yeah. And that's a big if.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, we're not counting on that.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody else should be. What I'm asking people to do this time is to count on their neighbors and friends and to reach out to anybody and everybody if they need help. This is a serious situation, and this shutdown at the federal government level, I think this brinksmanship that is being done, and I'm not going to wade into the politics any further than that. I think, though, we can all agree that's what it is, no matter what side we fall on, is going to have very serious, very real-world impacts on people in just a couple of days here, because mm-hmm. the SNAP funding usually is deposited in people's accounts on the first of the month. And even if this happens with a judge, I'm not so sure that that can occur tomorrow. So we are going to see people who are going hungry very early in the month, and are social services folks, our community resources folks, we're working with our food pantries. I know you've probably been talking to many of them, from the Federation for the Homeless to A Single Bite to Sullivan Farm Fresh to Sullivan Allies Leading Together Salt. We're all just pulling together to try to meet the need, although there's concerns that we won't be able to. But I call me a rose-colored optimist, or rose-colored glasses optimist. There we go. I'm an optimist who's colored rose. I do feel like we're in a county where people are going to pull together and care for one another. And if they see people who are hungry or know of people who need food, you know, I've seen it happen before where people have these huge medical bills, and it is amazing the amount of money that people will give. And I think people just need to really support, especially our local food pantries. They're the ones that can really do the work. If you want to support, I would urge people to contact them about how you can support them with time, money, and resources, because they're looking for that. On the county side, we are stocking up. We've tripled the normal order for our community assistance center pantry. We actually stock all the staple foods, everything from peanut butter to rice, in a facility not far from the county airport that we then make available to the local food pantries. And so I talked with our community resources commissioner, Laura Quigley, yesterday, and she said that order should be arriving shortly. Like I said, triple what we normally have. And then also she's working on some stuff that's going to, I think, go in front of legislators, where maybe the county can do even more direct aid. Can't talk about that yet because it has to be presented to legislators first, but it looks promising and hopeful. It's just the kind of thing I think we should be doing and what I would expect from people like Laura who really have a heart for the community. John Little, too, the Commissioner of Health and Human Services, they are working as hard as they can over there. They're very much constrained, of course, by state rules and regulations. And if the state says there's no money to give out, there's not money to give out. But there is public assistance benefits, emergency public assistance benefits that are not affected by this federal shutdown. They come from the state. And of course, if people need other things like shelter, we are standing ready to assist. We have not shut down.
And at the state level, Governor Kathy Hochul here in New York issued a state of emergency regarding this. What does that mean? And how does that help at the local level?
Well, it's from what I have been able to ascertain, it's not direct assistance to counties per se, but it is to food pantries and food relief organizations, which is where I think it should be going. The money needs to get to these organizations because they're on the front lines. They already were, but they're ever more so now. I'm sure, I think I heard Marty Colavito say the other day, he's already getting inundated with phone calls.
From Salt Care.
Yes. And so the money is going to go to our local food pantries and I think probably also the Hudson Valley Regional Food Bank, where a lot of us get food supplies from, to make sure that the food continues to flow where it needs to in Sullivan County, because we've got 6,000 people in Sullivan County who rely on SNAP benefits. And contrary to some of what I've seen on social media, these folks are not by and large people who are just feeding off of the system and are otherwise able-bodied and are just trying to milk taxpayers for all they can get. These are people who are in really difficult situations, a lot of what we might call the working poor. They actually have jobs. They're working as hard as they can, but the money is not there to feed their families. And I don't know about you, but I don't know that I want to live in a country where our own children are starving.
It is seniors, people with families, individuals, people with disabilities, folks who rely on food assistance to get them through. As you said, a lot of them have jobs. We spoke to Middletown Mayor Joseph DiStefano. I keep doing it wrong.
DiStefano.
I try to do it right and then I do it wrong. Why do I do that? About their emergency food relief program. They're going to find some assistance for families there, but also, Feeding America data highlighting that 1 in 8 people in Orange County and 1 in 7 people in Sullivan County don't have enough food to eat and are food insecure. So it is, neighbors helping neighbors that will help us get through this. You have a list of those opportunities for folks to help on your government website. We're going to get a list of those up on our website as well. We have also talked about other relief that is impacted by the government shutdown, the HEAP benefits. That's been delayed to November 17th. Any update there?
Yeah, it's not looking good.
Not good.
Because it's been delayed to the 17th. But if this federal shutdown continues, it's going to be delayed beyond that as well. So this November 17th number in certain respects is arbitrary. So HEAP is not starting as we were hoping it to on Monday. And I don't know that it'll be starting in the middle of November either. So that's another thing where if people need help in paying fuel bills and things, it's still something we want people to turn to us for. Contact our HEAP office, contact social services. We are going to uncover every rock we can to help you out. But this is the major way that we help, and that's currently not available.
We're talking to Dan Hoos, Communications Director for Sullivan County Government. He joins us every Friday. Other big news coming out of Monticello is the tentative budget that was proposed by County Manager Josh Potosik on Wednesday. This is, as you indicated last time you were here, last Friday, a tax hike is going to be proposed. And this tax hike proposed in this budget is about 9.1% increase in property taxes, driven largely by a slowdown in sales tax collections and some inflationary cost pressures. What can you tell us there?
Yeah, because this budget, which is just a little over $305 million, is actually less than 1%, even less than 0.9% higher than 2025's adopted budget. We have not added extra amounts of spending in here, even though inflationary costs have risen, as everybody is aware of. You go to the grocery store and you see it. Those costs affect the county as well. We have to purchase a lot of the same things that ordinary folk have to. The big issue, though, is the projected $5 million plus loss in sales tax revenue, which we had talked about last week, that I said I think has to do a lot with people's changing shopping habits. And also, what goes up must come down at some point or another. At this point, we're still thinking hopefully it's sort of plateaued. We don't think we're going to fall necessarily in free fall forever on that. But right now, it is falling. And it represents that $5 million loss represents 6.7% of the 9.1% property tax increase. If it weren't for that loss, we could come in close to or under the property tax cap.
So we've talked about the falling revenue and what you were looking to, what the county was looking at in terms of how to fill that gap. Originally, there may have been a much higher double-digit hike in property taxes. How did the county manager, get that down, deal with that, and make it not as painful, it seems?
Basically telling department heads and commissioners, I'm sorry, we cannot fill a position or add a position or add a program. We aren't cutting services. But we aren't really adding anything either. We already have some very expensive services that people have come to heavily rely on, like the Move Sullivan Transportation Service, the EMS fly cars, which don't fly, Tim. I know. I just want you to know.
I get the visual every time.
But those things cost millions of dollars to provide. And people could say, well, why do we need those? We could get rid of them. Well, you don't need them until you need them. And they have made a huge difference in the quality of life in Sullivan County. So there, as Josh said, Josh Potosik, the county manager, that there are services that taxpayers need and demand that we provide. So he's tried to do that without really adding or inflating the budget any further than has to. But the increased costs and the decreased revenue is causing an issue with that. But now, let me point out here, this now goes to legislators. So this the tentative budget is the county manager's to propose. The budget that is adopted will be adopted by the legislature. Those are the folks, the nine folks, everyone voted in to represent their interests. And so they're going to be looking at this very closely. They may make changes that could decrease that tax hike. I doubt they're going to look to increase it, but that's possible as well. And there's going to be a point for the community to talk to legislators about that. Actually, it exists already. You can call or email the legislature clerk, Anne Marie Martin, and we have that listed on the website, how to get in touch with her if you want to.
There's actual public hearings
coming up Tuesday, December 2nd at 5 p.m. and Thursday, December 4th at 10:45 a.m., both in the hearing room where the legislature meets in the Government Center in Monticello. So if you have something you want to say about that, come talk at those meetings. Now, if you have a question about it, call ahead of time. The public hearing is for the legislature to listen to what the public has to say rather than have it be a Q&A. You have questions ahead of time, get in touch with the legislature about it, and then they'll find the right person to talk to you to answer questions that you may have specifically about certain aspects of the budget, because the budget is available online to read in its entirety.
And you have that digital budget book, so folks can access it, as you said, online. There's a public hearing on December 2nd, one also on December 4th. Then legislators will vote on December 20th about how to adopt the budget for 2026.
And it may be earlier than that, no later than December 20th.
Yep. Let's talk about the broadband project. We talked about it a lot, but this broadband installation has started.
It has started, yes, just over the hill from JFF here, actually, over on, I think, Cold Spring and Aiden Roads is where the trenching has begun. Of course, I know that in part because our private partner, Archtop Fiber, is doing it, but we've heard from some town officials and also some residents who are like, wait a minute, why are you tearing up my front lawn? Well, it's trenching. The 97%, 98% of this project is going to be underground. So we're trenching only in rights of way where we have the proper state and local permissions to do it. And it doesn't require a property owner's permission per se. If there's some sort of environmental wetland or something, we have to be careful about that. But it is only temporary. Archtop Fiber is under strict rules and orders to return the property to the condition it was before they started digging. Of course, it being winter, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's going to be green in the next few months. I wish. But we are starting that. And the plan, it's this $30 million grant the county got that it's funneling to Archtop Fiber to wire. It'll be probably close to 70% of the county between wired and wireless service will have new high-speed, low-cost internet service. I'm not sure when Archtop Fiber is going to start the actual service. Right now, they have to get the backbone of it installed through the county. So I think it probably won't be till next year that people start seeing advertisements from Archtop to sign up for the service. But it's pretty cool, especially since we're hearing, too, that there's more funding that will probably be available to allow us to get as close to that 100% coverage as we wish we can. Some places will just never be economical or be too far in some hollow in the woods where we can't get them. But we're thinking we might be able to even get up to 98, 99% coverage of the county, which has never occurred before.
Is there a place where folks can find out where the trenching is taking place?
Archtopfiber.com. They are going to be updating their map shortly. I don't know that it's updated quite yet, but that's where they're going to keep a map going, an interactive map of where it's going to be happening. And also they're going to start tagging doors of properties where they're going to go
so
to
they're letting folks
so that
know,
people
not
will
just
know.
Showing
yes.
It.
Yep. Okay. But it's the very beginning of it. So there's always going to be some hiccups with that. Yep. And we're learning as we go along, because just like Archtop Fiber, we don't want to inconvenience people any more than we absolutely have to. So we're as I said, learning as we go along here to make sure that whatever hiccups are happening now, that we can not have them happen in the future. Because this phase of the project is going through December of next year.
The election is on Tuesday. How long does early voting last in New York, Sullivan County? And then what is the procedure for Tuesday?
Early voting lasts till Sunday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. So that's your final chance to do some early voting. Of course, our Board of Elections will be working on Monday, but we won't have any early voting available then, so they can sort of catch their breath for Tuesday, Election Day, which will be 6 a.m. to 9 p.m. polls open across Sullivan County. Of course, there are deadlines if you look on the Board of Elections website with absentee and everything. It's something I just want to put out there. Somebody told me, though, be careful about waiting to the last minute to send something in if it needs a postmark, because they had the experience, I guess, with paying taxes or something, that they tried to pay it on, what, September 30th, the postmark it there, but it didn't get postmarked until like October 1st or 2nd or something, and it got returned. So
it happened over here too.
Yeah, so it's not a good idea on anything to wait till the last minute, but in particular if you're going to do some sort of absentee voting.
Yeah.
We have so many other options anyway: early voting, voting in person. And something to mention too, on Tuesday, per all the labor union contracts with the county, county government is actually closed on Tuesday, November 4th, for Election Day, except, of course, for the Board of Elections, who will be working furiously that day.
And again, you can find more information about voting, voting resources, and candidate interviews at our website, wjffradio.org. I want to remind folks about some services that are being offered as the cooler weather comes in. Warming centers start to open on November 21st.
Yes. Yes, they'll be open from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. every night through usually mid-April, although we can extend it if the cold weather stays with us. But those will be at the St. John Street Episcopal Church on St. John Street in Monticello, within sight of the county courthouse right off Broadway. And also at the Liberty United Methodist Church, which is on North Main Street, sort of across from the Liberty Village Police Department. And those are being manned through our partners in SALT, Federation for the Homeless. We're just very grateful for these folks because they're volunteers who are basically making sure that these places are manned overnight when the rest of us are asleep and hopefully warm and safe in bed. We want to make sure everybody else is warm and safe in bed too.
A couple of meeting reminders: a Drug Task Force public meeting coming up November 7th.
Yes. This is an interesting thing I encourage people to go to. Anybody from the public that I've ever seen who's gone to this has come away with a much greater understanding and admiration for the work that is being done. A lot of us just too often sit and complain, you know, I just saw somebody shooting up with drugs, or I have a family member who has a substance abuser in the family who just, you know, it doesn't seem like anything is ever getting better with that. Well, we work on it every day and things are getting better. Yeah, some things aren't, but the work goes on. I mean, this drug task force probably will never cease to exist because it's just part of human existence these days. But you will see what numerous parts of the community are doing about this. You won't just hear from law enforcement, which is about, you know, making sure that the laws are adhered to and people who, like drug dealers and stuff, are caught and prosecuted. You also hear about the people involved in prevention, in treatment, and how all of those interact, that there's actually wonderful collaboration between our different community agencies and law enforcement agencies that are working on this, because everybody really wants the same thing, for people to recover from this, to get better, to not get addicted to begin with. So I encourage folks to come watch that. It'll be at the Government Center in the hearing room on November 7th at 2 p.m. Everyone's invited.
And there's a public reception and dedication for the airport terminal for the public. There was a ribbon cutting, but that was more of a private event.
Yeah, that was state run and it was invitation only. Now that I get to do something as County Communications Director and a big proponent of the airport. I've worked with Public Works to set up a public reception and building dedication. We have a beautiful plaque that just got finished that dedicates the new airport terminal. It's going to be November 16th, 1 to 4 p.m. You heard it here first. I have not done any other promotion of it yet, but I will be next week. And it should be a fun thing. We'll have some light refreshments, probably coffee and cupcakes and things like that. And then also just a very short program. The most of the 3 hours from 1 to 4 p.m. will be to give people tours of the building and answer questions. And so if you have questions, if you have concerns, if you're just nosy like me, come on and see what we did at this building.
I'm sure that some folks probably will have some questions.
Sure.
Given the tentative budget, this
absolutely
being spent here, what is this? How does this all work? We've discussed this, but get an opportunity to be heard.
And not only be heard, but also have questions answered to, so they can better understand. Because I think there's some misunderstanding out there as to what this is all meant for and meant to do. And as I said before, the real push here is to have it be a revenue generator that actually takes the airport off the shoulders of taxpayers.
Speaking of buildings, the fire training facility was renamed, dedicated. Talk about...
Yes.
Who was the beneficiary of that?
The late Richard, well, we all knew him as Dick Martinkovic. He passed away earlier this year. We invited his widow and his daughter, Janet and Jill, to our fire training facility. I know it as our emergency operations center over near the airport in Swan Lake. It is where our Division of Public Safety is headquartered, and also where we do a lot of training for firefighters and EMS. There's even police training that can go on there. We've done citizen preparedness training there. Richard, or Dick Martinkovic, was our public safety commissioner for many years, also our fire coordinator for many years, also was a Town of Liberty supervisor for many years, and he just was the kind of community advocate and leader that we all looked up to, and so we named the building after him in a ceremony on Sunday. I recorded the whole thing, put that up if people want to see that on our social media page. It was a very fitting ceremony, a bit of an emotional one for his family and the people who were there, that we had firefighters dressed to the nines as usual, and now it is the Richard Dick Martinkovic Public Safety Facility.
And today, Halloween, of course, I remarked when you came in that you're not in costume, but that does not mean that you are not going to be later today. No,
my costume's a little bit, I found out last night when I tried it on for the first time, it's a little difficult to navigate narrow openings with it. It is an inflatable triceratops that makes it look like I'm riding it with these tiny stubby legs. Whereas my real legs are the legs of the triceratops, but I've never done an inflatable costume before, so I had to figure out how to insert the fan in the right place so that it would inflate, because I was like, otherwise it looks like I'm just walking around with a whole bunch of ragged fabric all over me. So, but we're going to be entertaining the kids in the Government Center from Rutherford School, and I think also Healthy Families. I wanted to have something that wasn't scary. but also maybe would make my coworkers laugh as well. So you're going to see some pictures and video of that later today. Our legislature clerk, Annie, is already dressed as a cow, which is also an inflatable one. She's hilarious. And there's our treasurer's office. They all dressed up in camouflage. So if you don't see anybody when you walk into the office, just call out. They're there.
Goodness gracious. The puns. Well, I haven't seen it, but I'm smiling already. So send some pictures.
It'll be laugh out loud funny.
Dan Hoost, Sullivan County Government. Thank you so much. Happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, everyone.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, news from The Overlook. Editor Noah Eckstein is here to talk about how the Ulster County Meals on Wheels is feeding household neighbors, homebound neighbors, and also helping out as this federal food assistance is threatened to be cut off. Plus more after a break. This is Radio Chatskill.
Modern pop and rock songs can be transformed by a little focused imagination into something new and special. Next time on The Waggler and the Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, focused reworkings of pop and rock songs on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour, Jon Stewart on why America keeps falling for Donald Trump.
When someone comes along and goes, the system is rigged, and people go, yeah, it is rigged. Now, he's a good diagnostician. I don't particularly care for his remedy.
Jon Stewart joins me next time on the New Yorker Radio Hour. Listen Sunday at 6 for the New Yorker Radio Hour on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Overlook is community journalism serving Hunter, Hurley, Olive, Socrates, Shandaken, and Woodstock. And editor Noah Eckstein is here to tell us more about their latest issue. Noah, good morning.
Good morning.
Your lead story is talking about how Woodstock is stepping up the Meals on Wheels program there, marking its 50th year feeding folks. And how are they helping in terms of, you know, helping folks as this federal assistance cutoff is looming?
Yeah, so the way that we reported this story on the potential deadline on SNAP benefits ending tomorrow, November 1st, is embedding with the local Woodstock Meals on Wheels chapter. They're not affiliated with the bigger nationwide nonprofit, but they provide around 50 to 70 meals a day. Their staff of volunteers are all retired, and they drive 55 miles, you know, throughout the Catskills back roads to get people their food. So we followed them on their drive, and we met this woman, Bridget O'Hara Effrige. She's 74 years old. She lives in Woodstock, the same house that her father, the renowned WPA-era artist Antine Refrige, bought in the 1930s. He was an immigrant who, you know, was a muralist, an artist that got money through a federal art project during the New Deal era that employed artists during the Great Depression. And, you know, she is completely homebound. She doesn't drive. She's on SNAP. She's on federal assistance. And this is a lifeline for her, and it's often the only human contact that she has in a day.
Yeah, what's great about this story, which is at theoverlooknews.com right now, is the human aspect of it. You have not only spoke to these folks, you have photos of the folks who are receiving the benefits, but also some of the folks who are prepping them. Kitchen manager Leslie Siegel, who herself is 80 years old, is there making food for folks. Talk a little bit more about the human aspect of what you guys reported.
Yeah, I mean, they get to the kitchen at the Woodstock Reformist Church every morning at 7:30, and they have 2 hours to make a wholesome, nutritious meal with a protein, a starch, you know, a vegetable, and then they're often thinking of desserts as well. Leslie is 80 years old. Not too long ago, she had a surgery that kept her homebound, and the Meals on Wheels program delivered it to her. So it's not only about people who are impoverished, living in a trailer in Phoenicia, but it's also about, you know, just helping community members who can't access food. but they are totally expecting an uptick in need in the community with the SNAP deadline. And it's just a bunch of people, you know, retirees in the community who get together every morning, and then they pass the meals on to other volunteers who drive. Some of them are students with autism at the Anderson School for Autism in Slottsburg, New York. So it's really a community effort.
Yeah, and we were talking with Sullivan County spokesperson Dan Hoost about the number of people in Sullivan County that rely on SNAP benefits. That's about 6,000. In Ulster County alone, more than nearly 17,000 people rely on SNAP. So a deepening crisis, a system under strain. You can look at, for that reporting at theoverlooknews.com and also learn how in Ulster you can help. Want to talk about some other stories, a little lighter side of things for the holiday of Halloween. Indie horror icon Larry Fessenden. Tell folks about Larry and you know, why he is such an icon in the horror genre.
Yeah, Larry, he lives in West Shokan. He is in the news right now because he was in a sort of indie horror film that's out now. It came out last month called Good Boy. It tells the story of like a supernatural horror film, but from the perspective of a dog. He has collaborated with Martin Scorsese. He smoked joints with Jack Nicholson. He is in the background of so many, like Jim Jarmusch's movies. And we thought it would be just a great time to profile him and get to know him more. You know, he sees monsters as mirrors, reflections of our own loneliness and fear. And, you know, one line that stuck with me that he mentioned, he said, horror is just a response to the chaos and dread of life. You know, so many people look at the horror genre and are turned off by gore and these really vile aspects that it shows. But he looks at it more as a window into the deepest parts of our soul.
And you got to spend some time with him, or the reporter, John, got to spend some time with him at his home. Jim Rich. One of the photos is a little creepy. It's the Charlie McCarthy-esque doll head. I don't know why, but it kind of creeps me out.
Yeah, it's very creepy. I mean, it's similar to Guillermo del Toro, who like lives in a house filled with monsters. His he has like three sheds, barns on his property in West Shokan, and one of them is filled with werewolves and ventriloquist dolls, and just really, really creepy. But iconic imagery from the history of horror.
An interesting thing, too, is from his wife, Beck Underwood, who said that she thinks of Larry as kind of a Renaissance man. But then Larry is also talking about how he's sort of, you know, haunted by the specter of family.
Yeah. I think it weighs on him a bit, you know, that, well, he has a son, so he's thinking about legacy and the future.
And how, you know, the loneliness of that, and his father who passed away a few years ago, his mother passed away recently. So it sounds like it's, you know, weighing on him a bit, but also he is, you know, a Renaissance man, as Beck says, and also having more of a spotlight currently in the horror genre. One other story. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think, like he says here, that his movies are haunted by the father-son relationship, so he thinks about that relationship a lot. But his son, Jack, is also a filmmaker, so he must have, you know, just being in that creative environment growing up, had a load of inspiration to become a filmmaker.
And also another story you have about the man behind the giant pumpkin. Let's talk to tell folks about this giant pumpkin in case they don't go along Route 212 in the Woodstock-Socrates area. It's an annual event.
So, no, it's basically, you know, so much of our journalism is focused just on our reporters who are out in the field just looking and seeing what's going on. Uh-huh. You know, this story, every time I drive from Saugerties to Woodstock or Woodstock to Saugerties, you see this giant pumpkin. And every time I'm like, what is the deal with this pumpkin? So I stopped and spoke to the man who made it. You know, he's a retired handyman who used to own a spray foam insulation business. And one day he just made this giant 500-pound pumpkin that he drags with like a forklift from the backwoods of his property along Route 212. And he drags it to the front of the property where everybody could see it, and people stop. It's become like a just a local staple. So it's good to have have a bit, to know a bit more about the guy behind it, you know?
Oh, exactly. And well, you see these things along the road all the time, and you wonder about this. This is a giant pumpkin. Explain how giant it is.
Oh, it's at least 20 feet high, full circumference. I mean, it's a giant pumpkin. It would take up most of my apartment. It's huge. And it cost him $600 to make. And, you know, during COVID, he sold all his spray foam insulation equipment. But he really regrets that because of how popular the pumpkin is and more people wanting art, you know, holiday-themed art like this. But as one woman pointed out to me this morning in a letter to the editor, spray foam insulation is not good for the environment, and it stays for many, many years, not biodegradable.
Well, hopefully he'll keep it there in his barn. What does he do with it after the Halloween season?
He just literally tomorrow he'll drag it just behind his house.
All right. That is Noah Eckstein, who is the editor of The Overlook. There's more information of the reporting that they have there, not only on the pumpkins, but so many other things, including all of their election coverage. You can meet the candidates there as well. It's at theoverlooknews.com. Also, just want to point out a nice obituary there for Jack DeJohnette, the musician who passed away recently, at theoverlooknews.com. Noah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, it's the latest edition of our theater podcast, Curtain Call. We'll talk to Tom Candela next. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week in This American Life. As of this year, refugees are basically not allowed into the United States, except for one lucky group.
Oh, yeah. No, we're all coming over. No, we'll see you soon.
Wow.
On our way, around the corner.
Winners, and how they made themselves winners. We get to know them. That's this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill, keeping Pennsylvania voters connected. Election day is Tuesday. Polls are open in Pennsylvania from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. County boards of elections must receive all mail-in ballots by the time polls close. If you've already submitted a mail-in or absentee ballot, you cannot vote at the polls. Find your polling place at pa.gov or vote411.org and access all of Radio Catskill's election coverage at wjffradio.org.
Oh, trick-or-treaters.
Get the candy.
Trick-or-treat.
Look at these costumes. We've got a vampire.
And a witch.
And what are you?
Oh, I'm an apple pie.
Ah!
Radio Catskill has more tasty terror than you've ever seen at Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
That sounds like a lot of pie.
A frightful amount of apple pie.
Ah!
There's pie to eat, pie to buy, for ghouls and gourmets alike. You're sure to savor every bootiful bite.
That pun was kind of scary.
It sure was.
Apple Pie Palooza-ween. Frightfully good fun to support Radio Catskill. 2 to 5 tomorrow afternoon. Catskill Brewery, Livingston Manor.
Happy Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
It's all right if you wear a costume, too.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. And I'm joined in the studio by Tom Candela, who is the host and producer of Curtain Call, our local theater podcast. But you may recognize the voice of the ghoulish narrator in that promo. That was you, Tom.
Indeed it was. Oh, that was a lot of fun. What a spot.
That's a good one. With thanks to Jason and Ronald for putting that one together, Ronald Kelson, to remind folks about Apple Pie Palooza-ween.
Yes, coming up soon this weekend.
You are very versatile. So let's talk about the latest episode of Curtain Call. It drops today. That's our theater podcast at wjffradio.org. What do you have on tap for us?
Well, I'm celebrating a reconnection reunion, if you will, with an old friend of mine, Gabriel Barry. Gabriel is a Tony-nominated actor, performer, director. He directed on Broadway, Amazing Grace, and many other shows. And he's got a new show this very weekend, opens up on the 2nd in New York City. It's called Reunions. And we talked a lot about our friendship. We talked about going back to the old days when we worked together at the Richard Morse Mime Theater. And then, of course, we focused on the show reunions. But it's a really good episode. I hope people, this is just a taste of it. I really do hope people go and listen to the full podcast.
Yeah, just a reminder for folks, Tom is here to give us a glimpse of the podcast here on Radio Chatskill on Fridays. But the full episode, usually they're, what, around an hour?
Yeah, about an hour. So it's sometimes a little bit longer, depending on how much music or how much we talk and stuff. I always put in music, and I put in music from Amazing Grace and some of the other shows that Gabe has done into this podcast. So it's a lot of fun.
So the full episode available now at WJFFradio.org. But let's hear a portion of that now. It's Curtain Call with Tom Candela. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Today, not only am I reacquainting myself with an old friend, but I have truly a remarkable artist as my guest today. And he is currently in the midst of getting ready to open his off-Broadway show. The opening of Reunions is going to be at City Stage 2. So it's really a pleasure to have on my show a longtime friend, Gabriel Barry. He is a Tony-nominated actor for his role on Broadway in Starmites. He is a director of the Broadway show Amazing Grace. And internationally, he has hits like Pippin, Billy Elliot, Here You Come Again. Gabe, I want to welcome you to Curtain Call.
Tom, thank you so much. It's so great to be reunited with you. I really miss you, and I'm proud of all you've done and accomplished as well.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I still remember very well the first time you and I met. I was fresh out of Circle in the Square Theater School, and I wanted to become a mime. And I found this theater company, Richard Morse Mime Theater. And I went there one day, and I walk in, and the first person I met was Gabe Barry. And we talked a little bit about mime and the theater company. And subsequently, I signed up for classes. And within, I don't know how many months, I was performing with the theater company, and you and I performed on stage together.
Those were really foundational and formative days and experiences we had together there.
They were
performing and learning from Richard, who was a mentor figure to me, really, and even became a sort of surrogate father figure in the years around that time.
But when you look back at that time, at the discipline and the physical storytelling, the ensemble work, how do you see those mime theater roots influencing the way you tell stories today on stage?
Well, that's a great question, and it permeates almost everything I do, to be honest with you. Creating pieces together with the mime theater really taught me about structure and storytelling. We worked mainly in short form, meaning doing vignettes and small pieces, but each vignette has a beginning, middle, and end. And if you're working non-verbally, it was also just such a important foundation for me to understand just how visual theater is. I mean,
right.
Theater is a visual medium first, I always say. And so it's really informed how physical I like theater to be. And as I direct, it informs me in terms of economy of movement and gesture, not just with the body, but in storytelling in general, focus and all of that. Those things become hugely important with the training we had and the shows that we performed in together and put together and created out of thin air, really, with nothing but ideas. So it really informs everything I do, both behind the table as a dramaturg, director, and on stage when I perform still.
I want our listeners to really understand a little bit about you, Gabe. And one of the things I always admired about you was how committed you were to your work. When you were auditioning for Barnum, it was the early 80s, you were teaching yourself how to ride a unicycle. And I remember you up on that little stage that we had on the unicycle, falling and falling and falling and falling and bruising your arm and hitting your head. But you were so intent on teaching yourself how to do that, that you kept doing it until you were an expert at it, along with tightrope walking and juggling and all the other things that you brought to your audition before you finally got that show. And so it was very inspiring to see that. So I really wanted our listeners to get that, to get the kind of work that went into your career at a very early stage of your career. So,
well, thanks for sharing that memory. I actually remember that now. But and I think anyone can attest to the fact that hard work, perseverance, persistence, and passion are essential for anything you want to really want to do or accomplish in life. So I saw it as an investment in myself as a performer, not just for that one show, but it was a great motivator too. And that was my first union show. It was indeed the first national tour of Barnum, where I played one of the four lead roles in it, the ringmaster. And I was really grateful for that. And for the, even for the audition experience, it was very thorough audition process. And I remember auditioning on the Broadway stage, the St. James Theater. And it was one of my first times on a Broadway stage. I came into the theater early for one of my callback auditions, and the Ghostlight was on stage. And I remember the stage manager let me out on stage because no one was there yet. And I stood in way at the edge of the stage and looked into this 1400 seat theater and said, I've got to fill this space. And I backed up towards the ghost light, and my shadow in the theater kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger until my shadow overcame the entire theater. And I said, that's what you have to do as a performer. Wow. You have to fill the space. And it was such a great metaphor and image for me that I use it to this day when I'm directing to help inform the principles of theater, of enhancement, enlargement, and enlightenment that I think theater has the ability to provide. So anyway, those skills I continue to employ, certainly when I am performing, rarely now, but still use those skills. But I also teach them to other performers or take advantage of them or look for performers that have those skills now to put in my shows, because I love tailoring performances to those skills. And so I'm always attracted to performers who, like me, spend hours working on one hat trick or whatever it might be. And so it continues to inform me today.
So Star Mites was another show that started on off Broadway, went to off Broadway, and eventually went to Broadway. And you played a pivotal role in that. Trinkelus, I believe the name of the character was. Really imaginative show, comic book type fantasy, lots of color and music and dance and movement. Again, all these things that you had acquired over the years. And you were nominated for a Tony Award for that role. And the show was nominated for a bunch of Tony Awards, if I remember correctly. So give us a little bit about what was that ride like for you?
It was a real fun ride to create the role and to do the show on Broadway, where we had a lot of adventures and fun. And of course, needless to say, it was a high honor to be nominated for a Tony Award for the role. And I would consider that a real blessing and treasure that as well. But great experiences and great performers.
Just amazing. So brings me to Amazing Grace, based on the life of John Newton, right? He's the man behind the hymn Amazing Grace that we're all familiar with. How did you get to direct that show?
Yeah, it's a unique story to the show itself. A gentleman who lived in New Hope, Pennsylvania. He was a police officer, actually, and was active in his church and was just loved writing music. And he stumbled upon John Newton's biography and read it, and he couldn't believe that, you know, someone else hadn't done a musical about him already. So he started to write songs for this musical and finally raised enough money on his own to quit his job as a policeman to dedicate himself to writing full time. His name is Chris Smith, and he sought out people in New York. He didn't know anybody, but was recommended to submit the script to a producer named Carolyn Rossi Copeland. And so when Carolyn got the script for Amazing Grace from Chris, she immediately thought of me, thank goodness, and called me and said, hey, would you like to be my partner in trying to get this thing on? And I read it and was very moved by the music and, of course, by the story of redemption and second chances. So I was really intrigued with it. And that started in, I think, 8-year process at least of doing readings of the show and then eventually a production at Goodspeed and other readings and productions and development, and then opened on Broadway. And it was just a thrilling experience.
But what I want to talk about now, Gabe, is the show that is getting ready to open. You have the opening performance in November. I think it's the 2nd. of November over at the City Stage in New York City. So this show, Reunions, again, it's an original musical, and it's sort of based on two different one-act plays. So give us an idea of how these two pieces came together to form this new piece, Reunions.
Sure. Well, the writer, Jeffrey Scharf, he's actually a financial wizard from California, but also a wonderfully talented playwright and lyricist. And so it became his dream and passion to see his show in New York, mounted here. So I met Jeffrey about a year ago. I came in May of this year to do a reading of the show. And so we all got in a room together with some really smart actors and started working on the piece and put it together. It was Jeffrey's idea to take these two disparate one-act plays, 12-pound Look and a play called A Sunny Morning, about a reunion of two people taking place in a park. And so Jeffrey thought there was some nice symbiosis between the two pieces, thematic connections. So he called the assembly of those two pieces Reunions, plural. And again, we did a reading of it. And it was my strong conviction that we should try to do it in one nonstop evening rather than in two halves.
It has original music, correct? It's a musical, right?
Yes, it's all, thanks for pointing that out. Yep. Yes, the text is from the plays. Mm-hmm. The interjection of music and songs is completely him and his collaborator. So yes, really done well, I think, to create a kind of musical vocabulary for each piece. And yet there's an overall voice to the show as well. So it is a really some nice touches and real fun flavors of the show.
So let's talk a little bit about where people can see the show. Give us the performance dates, where it's playing, and how people can get tickets.
Well, the show is playing at City Center, which is on 151 West 55th Street, and it's called Stage 2. And opening night is November 2nd, and it runs through December 15th, at least.
So I want to thank you. It's really an honor to have you on Curtain Call. I check this off as a big get to have Gabriel Barry on the show, and it's exciting, and I want to thank you for taking the time.
I appreciate your time, Tom, and your support for me and for the arts in general.
Yeah.
Really proud of you, too.
Thank you. It's a lot of fun. Well, that's great. Well, let me give you the information again. The name of the show is Reunions. It is a brand new musical directed and choreographed by our guest today, Gabriel Barry, and it is playing over at the New York City Center Stage 2. For information about tickets, you go to www.nyctycenter.org. That's www.nyctycenter.org.
And thanks, Tom, for that. The full episode of Curtain Call and all of the episodes of Curtain Call are at our website, wjffradio.org. And a reminder that Apple Pie Paloozaween is tomorrow at Catskill Brewery from 2 to 5. There's still time to enter the baking contest, so you can bake a apple pie or any kind of apple creation for the chance to win the crown of best apple pie in town. Also, if you are scared by baking, you can just eat pie and buy pie. Tomorrow, we've got great donations from a lot of local bakers and bakeries for you to sample, and all the proceeds will benefit the station. Don't be scared. Treat yourself. That's tomorrow from 2 to 5, Catskill Brewery in Livingston Manor. You can find out more information and also enter that baking contest at wjffradio.org. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'll see you there tomorrow. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support comes from Catskill's Property Care, offering full property care year-round for commercial and residential properties in Sullivan County, including snow plowing, landscaping, property checkups, and more. Information at CatskillsPropertyCare.com. And from the Calicoon Theater, an updated vintage movie theater with new film releases, live music, and more. CalicoonTheater.com. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
This week on CatsCast. Warm autumnal days can be delightful, but what about those ticks?
Dr. Saravanan Tangamani runs the Tangamani Lab at Upstate Medical University, leading the way in tick-borne pathogen detection.
No matter how difficult the time is going to be with the funding, we're going to continue to do it because for the larger good of the community, for the larger good of the epidemiology world, our work is really, really important.
Saturday at 11 a.m., right here on Radio Catskill.
It's Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. There's a wind advisory for the region in effect until 5 a.m. tomorrow. Wind gusts of up to 50 miles an hour could be occurring. Gusty winds could blow around unsecured objects. Tree limbs could be blown down, and there could be a few power outages. Also, if you're in a high-profile vehicle, winds can make driving difficult, so use extra caution and secure those outdoor objects. The high today, 45. Tonight, a wind continuing again, low 39 for tomorrow. An apple pie, Paloozaween. Areas of some low clouds, breezy but not as windy, high 46. And for Sunday, times of some clouds and sun mixed, not as windy, and a high of 49. On Point is coming up next. It's 11 o'clock.
WJFF Jeffersonville. From river to river, mountain to mountain, we are Radio Catskill.